I think I just invented a new kind of hot dog.
Okay. Tell me all the details. I need the deets.
Okay. So I had about 15 minutes that we were pushing back recording, and I realized that I hadn't eaten anything today. So I ran to the fast food grill place down the street called Choppers. And I went in and I ordered a chili dog because I thought that was the sort of the genre of food that I could put into my mouth most efficiently.
Uh-huh.
I'd really just sort of cram it in there. And then they said, what do you want on it? And I said, everything. And what they did was they made a whole Chicago-style hot dog, and then they put the chili over it. But it was very good.
So what all goes – and I'm going to reveal my ignorance here because I'm not too proud for that. What goes onto a Chicago-style hot dog?
Well, Pat, I'm glad you asked. So an authentic Chicago-style hot dog is you start with a 100% all-beef, kosher Vienna beef hot dog with a natural casing. And that goes into a steamed Rosen poppy seed bun. It's got to be Rosen brand, and it should be properly steamed. Most people don't steam their buns. Then on top of the hot dog, you get a spear of dill pickle. You get 2 to 3 sort of wedges of tomato. You get the neon green relish, the yellow French's mustard, a little chopped onion, and then right at the end, you hit it with some celery salt.
Wow, that is way more elaborate than I'd anticipated. I was kind of...
Oh, wait, I forgot something. You get the banana, the sport peppers, the little, you know, the little pickled sport peppers?
Uh-huh.
You get those on there, too.
On there or just on the side?
No. On the laying lengthwise along the hot dog. So you would do 2 to 3 sport peppers.
So does it actually have to be that kind of bun, or is that like kind of a religious preference on your part? You know, because I know that sometimes people say, this is the only way you can have – oh, when I was in Spain, it was this traditional rice dish.
Paella.
Paella, you know, and like – I go, oh, yeah, paella, I'll try that. And somebody at the next table turned around and said, if this is your first time, don't eat it here. You're in the wrong part of the country. And, like, started a fight with the waiter and the person I was eating with. But, like, so is this actually, like, this poppy seed roll, is this an integral part of the Chicago hot dog too?
Well, when you ask, is it part of the religion, I mean – did Jesus divide the loaves of bread to feed the hungry, or is that just a story that we tell ourselves to feel better? I mean, I don't know. Who am I to say? But if you're going to eat a Chicago hot dog, it better be on a fucking Rosen steamed poppy seed bun.
Now, it's really funny because I kind of thought you said, oh, because like we had California burgers growing up, and what that was, it was like a hamburger and it had lettuce, tomato. You know, lettuce and tomato on it. And then we kind of call that a California burger. And so I kind of anticipated like, oh, Chicago hot dog. And I was like, oh, you know, it's like a regular hot dog, except you have like the relish and the mustard and, you know, and like, I kind of thought that would be it. It's like, it's with these three things, but this is arcane. This is I really feel like I've missed something and now I have to go experience this.
It's a really good hot dog. I mean, it's truly one of the best flavor combinations you can put into your mouth. I mean, it's fatty, it's salty, it's vinegary, it's spicy. It's just a perfect flavor to cram into your mouth. I really can't say enough good about the Chicago style hot dog.
Well, and then with the chili on top.
Now that was a bit of a mistake, but it was pretty good.
I would say that so long as it furthered the purpose of science,
yes,
it was not entirely a mistake.
What I was very distressed to see that you tweeted about 10 minutes ago, the tweet, this is a quote, fuck beets.
it was really misunderstood. I was just announcing, I was kind of claiming territory.
Okay.
I've been listening to a lot of MC Front a lot lately, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to lay claim to like – my handle. I go, I want to be DJ Fuckbeats.
Okay. So it's just your cool hip hop name.
No, I mean, beats are just a fucking repugnant vegetable. It's they cannot be salvaged. It's
so I used to be one of you. I used to wander alone in the darkness. and then Veronica brought me in and I've seen the light. Beets can be good. If you ever get a chance to do like a white beet, like an heirloom beet or like a like an interesting beet that actually has some flavor and it's not just sort of a soggy, upsetting purple, you know, obelisk, it's a very good food, and you can do it in like a salad with like blue cheese or goat cheese. Ooh, goat cheese and beets in a salad. Little walnuts in there. You got a salad going.
I will admit it's been a while since I've had beets, so you know, I'm not above occasionally just shooting my mouth off, but you know, I went downstairs here. I came over to the temple to record, and the whole place smells like delicious food because we have somebody on Mondays come in and she cooks for the team, and then the food kind of lasts for a couple of days, and it lets everybody eat healthier, and so they don't like, you know, go out, and pretty much it's to keep them in the building, you know,
it's
like
to keep them from doing what I just did, which is to eat a Chicago style hot dog smothered in chili and then fall asleep halfway through the podcast.
You know, and it's this woman is a great cook, and she uses stuff like that's seasonal, and it's all from like local farms. And so I went downstairs, and I kind of feel it's kind of weird because, you know, this is my team. I do kind of work here too. It's my building, you know, but I don't work here every day. And so I show up like in the middle of the night to sign books, and I go down into the fridge, and there's a bunch of food in there. And I kind of feel like it's my fridge, like my house, my rules. I feel like the dad. But then I'm always worried. It's like, am I eating somebody's lunch that they've left here? But anyway, I went down there thinking, wow, this really smells good. Something, they made something really good today. And it's Monday, so there's going to be some left over. And what do? I go down there, and there's borscht. And I'm like, that is the worst, to have something in this place that smells good, and all that is left in this fridge is some sort of beet derivative pseudo food substance. But that said, I really have not tried beets in a couple of years, but my previous experiences have not been pleasant. It'll take a little while to bring me around.
Now, with regards to you being the dad, we recently wrote the Cards Against Humanity card. I think as of yet unpublished, Father's Forbidden Chocolates, which is like one of the funniest things we've ever written. Because I don't know why, because it's not a thing that any of our dads like actually had, but it's just sort of emotionally true. Like my dad had certain forbidden like beverages in the refrigerator that we weren't allowed to drink, like the Diet Raspberry Snapples. Is that a dad thing? Did your dad do that? And now that you're a dad, do you do that?
There are not... You know, there aren't foods that I like hide in the house. If anything, it's the opposite way, where like Sarah makes food and then gets upset at me for eating it. You know, most notably, I think like we had guests over, and so she was ready to cook a big breakfast. And so she did, and everybody ate this breakfast, and there was waffles and eggs and whatever. But she also went a little crazy. And so she's like, well, since I'm here and I'm cooking, I'll cook the entire 2 pounds of bacon. And then I live in the house, and then all the guests leave, and I go downstairs, and I'm hungry, and what's in the fridge? Well, bacon. Well, I'll eat some of that. And then later on that night, I go into the fridge, and hey, what do you know? More bacon. It's still there. And so I eat some of that. And then the next day I wake up, and I'm kind of looking for something to eat. You know, I'm kind of a hunter-gatherer type, And I'm like, hey, more bacon. And so over the space of like a day and a half, I ate like this 2 pounds of bacon. And she was horrified. And I'm like, don't even pretend. I mean, like how is that a wrong thing? You cooked this food. It was in the fridge.
Now, this was pre the breakfast or after the breakfast had already happened, and it was reserve bacon.
Oh, no. This was total reserve bacon. It would be a dick move to like eat, you know, food that was prepared for guests or for a special occasion. But no, this was like the surplus bacon that was cooked, you know, to kind of like to cook it all. So it was kind of out of the way. And she was like, really? She was upset for one, I think that I had just eaten, you know, 2 pounds of bacon and that it would kill me. But the other thing was sort of like, who does that? And I'm like, who doesn't do that? It was like the easiest food available in the fridge. It was the low-hanging fruit. except it wasn't even fruit. It was bacon. Low-hanging.
The low-hanging bacon.
Yeah, low-hanging bacon. But, you know, and then she'll bring home a bag of chips. And then at 2:30 in the morning after I'm exhausted and I'm ready to go to bed and I look around the kitchen, I'm like, well, I can spend 45 minutes making something. I can order a pizza that'll be here in 20 minutes. It'll be like driving a nail through my heart. Or I guess I can eat half a bag of chips, you know? I know none of those are good options, but I guess my problem is that I do go for the low hanging fruit.
Now, do you cook, or I mean, I know Sarah's a good cook. Is that sort of your department as well?
I love to cook. You know, the problem is, as I've gotten busier and busier, I keep talking myself out of the time that it would require me to cook. You know, even making something like mac and cheese is going to effectively take me, you know, 25 minutes. And so I kind of look in the fridge and I'm like, well, you know, there's a tomato, you know, it's like, I can just eat this tomato. And that actually would be a great option if it was just, oh no, another tomato, then that would be kind of healthy. But
yes, except a tomato should never be in the refrigerator. There's no, unless you're trying to destroy a tomato for some sort of ritual.
Actually, there's been some new research about that, because I know traditionally you're not supposed to refrigerate a tomato.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is one of the people that was a huge don't refrigerate the tomato, you know, one of those advocates, he actually said, well, hold on. You know, like what I do is like I go buy fresh heirloom tomatoes from the farmer's market for all these things. He goes, but most people, that is not their tomato experience. They buy tomatoes from the grocery store. And he goes, I wonder how, you know, what the differences are. And so he took like the tomatoes he buys, because he's a huge geeky foodie. And then he took like some, you know, whatever, like pseudo organic, you know, grocery store tomatoes, and then some total low tier tomatoes. And then he tried some of them in the fridge and out of the fridge. And he said, actually, if, you know, you're getting these store-bought tomatoes and you're not going to be eating them in a day or two, they actually maintain much better with a little bit of refrigeration.
Well, this is – now we're getting into territory where I have no idea what I'm talking about. But I would guess that sort of the average sort of store-bought like beefsteak tomato that people get at, you know, I don't know, at the Jewel or whatever people have, you know.
Ralph's.
The Ralph's. Yeah, exactly. I would guess that those are bred to withstand refrigeration because they need to sit in a grocery store, you know, a refrigerated aisle for weeks at a time. But really, you're not eating a tomato. You're eating sort of a watery red sack.
Yeah.
I mean, the difference between – I mean, you know, if you go to that – you ever do the Madison Farmers Market?
You know, when I lived near Madison, I wasn't into it. But I know of it. And Maria is quite often at there because – you know, selling chickens or the other things that she grows on her farm.
I mean, best farmer's market I've ever been to, maybe like best in the world, but crazy, amazing farmer's market. And there's, I mean, really, you know, when you go get that like farm fresh tomato and it's like warm from sitting in the sun, you sit there with like a thing of salt and eat that tomato. That's a different food.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I don't know about you, but my Twitter feed has been completely full of people saying, of course I listen to Prairie Home Companion.
I got a lot of that too, actually.
Yeah. and given the vehemence of that response, I don't feel too bad mentioning it again, knowing that the other people that listen to this podcast would probably enjoy Prairie Home Companion if they checked it out. You know, he talks about tomatoes a lot there, And it is true, you know, a tomato that you grow in your own garden, you know, something that you buy from a farmer at the farmer's market. Part of me kind of is resistant to the term heirloom anything, but what it helps me just because it's used so much and it's so trendy. But what helps me get over at that is the realization that, you know, you're right. These tomatoes that you buy in the grocery store, their primary characteristic has to be that they travel well and they last a long time on a shelf, because that's what's important for, you know, a big centralized food industry. But there are, you know, there's a ton of these vegetables and fruits that, you know, like, nobody ever eats because they only grow in one place, or they only last a week after you harvest it. I mean, just think about that. Like, any food that only lasts a week after you harvest it, nobody could ever ship or sell in a store, not even a co-op, pretty much.
There's a great article in one of the early issues of Lucky Peach, which is a great food magazine that I really like. It's like all like food journalism. And they talk about apricots, and that the fruit that you or I know as an apricot is like basically like a pale imitation of a wild apricot. And wild apricots are these like juicy, succulent, sweet, sugary things, but they only are good for a few days.
Yep.
And then they sort of fall to the ground and rot. So you can go to – there's a couple of farms in California that grow heirloom apricots, and this guy goes and just eats all these different kinds of apricots. And he's like, it's such a tragedy that these things could never be – you could never sort of distribute these at scale, but it's like probably the most delicious fruit you could ever eat. The other thing is do you have Netflix?
You know, I do not. Sarah has a Netflix account. I spend so much time in front of the computer that the thought of watching movies in front of the computer too kind of horrifies me.
Well, I recommend if you guys can watch it on Sarah's account, there's this great Netflix did this documentary series called Chef's Table. And I think it's like 6 episodes. They're each an hour long, and they pick an interesting chef who has sort of like a point of view about food, and they go profile that chef in this like gorgeous, thoughtful documentary about their creative process and their life and their philosophy. And one of the guys is one of my favorite chefs, Dan Barber from Blue Hill Farms. And he is all about that cooking begins with the farm, and that to get Americans to care about slow food and farm reform and healthy sort of agriculture processes, that starts and ends on the plate. Like, you have to sort of prove to people that the food is superior, that the ingredient is superior. And in one of my favorite segments in that episode, you go meet one of the farmers he works with. It's like they're like academics that breed interesting foods. And he has them breed a squash, and he says, could you breed a squash for flavor? Could you breed a squash that tastes the best? And the guy, you can see the guy is like taken aback. And he's like, no one has ever asked me to breed a food so that it tastes the best. People breed squashes so they have the hardest skin and they last the longest and they ship the best. But no one's ever asked a question, what does it look like to breed a squash so that it tastes the best? And Dan Barber does this squash at his restaurant that's like this, you know, the squash that's grown for the restaurant that's bred for flavor. And you can just see people's like jaw drop when they eat it. Like, now I'm like dying to go to this restaurant and try the stuff that he's doing, because it's such a different way of thinking about food. But I'll put the links to this episode of Chef's Table in the show notes. But one of my favorite food things in the last few years, I love it.
You know, the squash. What is the plural of squash? Squash.
Let's say yes. Squashes.
I think it's a non-count noun, like jewelry. You always have jewelry or jewelry. You don't never have jewelries.
Mm-hmm. It says squashes.
Squashes?
Squashes and gourds. I really enjoy the word squashes.
I do like squashes too. I'm glad that is the plural. We grew some. You know, I grew up, my mom was a big gardener, and she would do canning and I would kind of putter around in the garden with her, probably being more nuisance than help. But, you know, we grew a garden once and we got all these squash, and so then you harvest them. And it's one thing to say, you know, like, it's true that there's this new thing about, yeah, it's going to go to a distribution center, and then it's going to go from the distribution center to the grocery store, and then it's going to sit in back stock until there's room on the shelf. So it's like, you really do need a tomato that will last 4 weeks. Which is kind of horrifying if you've ever grown a tomato. You know that, like, a real tomato out of your garden, just the thought of it lasting 4 weeks is nonsense. But, you know, when we grew these squash, and then we got so many squash and so many pumpkins, and we brought them inside. And for one thing, it's like, I'm not a big fan of squash. So it wasn't like, hey, let's have another squash tonight. It was just sort of like they just were around like pottery gnomes, mostly.
You had a lot of decorative gourds.
Decorative gourds, yeah. But then, like, they lasted. And, you know, even before that, somebody gave me a squash, you know, because they had a bunch in their garden and they gave them out at the university when I was teaching. And that squash lasted like a year and a half. Like, it was just – and it's not like I put it in a root cellar. I didn't take care of it. It sat on a shelf. I actually moved from one apartment to the next, took the squash with me, and occasionally I would go over to it thinking, oh, God, I'm going to touch it. It's going to be soft and wet. It's going to be leaking juice all over, and it would be hard. It would be like I would tap it. And – but, I mean, think about it. Think about a Wisconsin winter. You need – you know, you need to be able to lay in enough food that will last you 6 months, you know, 7 months, 8 months, because just because springtime rolls around doesn't mean that there's suddenly food coming up in your garden. Seeing those squash and how long they lasted made me realize how people, you know, exist in a climate like mine.
You want to know a great, I learned a great word speaking of root cellars. So do you know what the door of the root cellar is called?
Oh, boy. No, I don't.
It's the wazoo.
No.
Yes. So when you say – so the phrase out the wazoo, when you say I have squashes out the wazoo, it means that your root cellar is overflowing with squashes.
Oh, that is the best.
Isn't that great?
That is the best thing that I've heard today.
I hope that's not a thing that I just made up. We got to get into the hard drive.
Into the hard drive. What is this a euphemism for something?
It's not a euphemism for something. If you recall, less than a week ago, you called me. I was at parted ways at Gen Con. You had an early flight, and I was out to breakfast with our friends Molly and Ben. And I get a text from you, and it just said something horrible has happened. I'm on my my flight, and I don't have my hard drive. I think it's at security. And then I wound up talking with Amanda, and we wound up on the phone with security. Like, I was calling TSA and I was arguing. You had someone told me the brand, and I was arguing with them. I was like, no, I know you have it. You got to, you know, you got to help me pick up this hard drive. Cause I was still in Indianapolis. So I was going to go drive over to the airport and get this thing for you. And then things sort of went quiet for a while. And then the next thing I heard was from Amanda, and she was like, Pat got it. And I know there must be a story here. I'm dying to know what happened.
There is. And I actually am, you know, I'm, like I think I've already said it once, you know, in this thing, I have no particular shame, but I do have a certain amount of embarrassment for what actually went down. And so now I'm just parsing, you know, will it be better for me to make a clean breast of this and get it off my chest? Because it's been rolling around in my head and I've been feeling, you know, more than my usual amount of Midwestern guilt. Like I feel burdened by what I actually did in the airport
Listen, I mean, here's the upshot too of talking about it is basically, unless you're Edward Snowden, you should not have one hard drive with all your work on it, where if you lose it, you're in trouble. Like that, that is a total disaster. So tell me what happened, and then let me help you. Help me help you, Pat.
it would not have been this. I can talk about, and I'll sort of roll the other, like, what actually happened in the airport around in my head, to see if I want to make a confession of that. So I do. I had on me my pen drive, you know, which has pretty much everything that is really important to me is on that drive. It used to be much better maintained. I would do everything off of that pen drive, and then I would back it up to my various computers. Mm-hmm. These days, I'm not quite as centralized as I wish I were. But the truth is, you know, I would not have lost a ton of things. I would not have lost a lot of work on the book, you know, any essential files. My real anxiety came from the fact that, you know, because I was on the airplane. I'd gone through security. It was fairly early in the morning, given how late I'd been to bed. I just finished 3 week-long trips attached to different conventions. I was kind of burned out. Went through security. Opted out of their Omnitron fucking cancer machine that they claim is totally healthy for you, but nobody has ever actually tested.
What are you talking about? It's great for you to get x-rayed all the time.
Uh-huh, yeah. Do you go through that? Because I know you have to travel a fair amount. Do you actually just let them zap you with that thing every time you go through?
It depends how much of a hurry I'm in. My goal is to I would like to die having spent the least amount of time possible in airports. So I usually show up 7 to 8 minutes before my flight takes off and then sort of frantically run through security. So if I'm in that, you know, time crunch, I will not opt out. But if something goes horribly awry and I'm there like an hour early, I will opt out and I'll get the pat down.
Yeah, I always opt out, just mostly because at this point I'm doing it out of principle. Because they know that it's useless. I mean, they've proven that it's useless. People have admitted that they're not secure. Everybody leaks photos from them.
It's slightly worse than useless because it gives people a false sense of security and it prevents us from doing any actual sensible things like gun control that would actually stop weapons from getting on airplanes. But this is probably an argument for another time. But
yeah. Yeah. It's, I find it so galling. And then they're going to put me in a machine that, they're like, no, it's totally safe. But there's absolutely no, they've never tested it. They've never done anything to prove that it is safe. It is pure bullshittery. And I find it so galling. So no, I will absolutely fucking hold up that line and make you touch my fat body. You know, I'm here to wreck your day.
Oh no.
And so, yeah, I go through it and normally it's like, it's a process, you know, and I'm like, I know it. I put my hands up, I put my hands down. I kind of sleepwalk through, you know, their introduction. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to use the back of my hands in the sensitive areas of blah, blah, blah. And I kind of bite my tongue to keep from doing anything like really snarky, you know, during that talk. But so we go through and I realize I've spaced out and I did actually leave my pen drive in my pocket. You know, and it's a Corsair Survivor. It's this black anodized aluminum. It's about as big around as my thumb. You can run it over with a car. It's water resistant. You know, the thing is really indestructible. And so I pull it out, and then, of course, because it's not just like folding money or anything like that, they have to run it through the machine. So, you know, they do that. They run it through the machine. It's this guy's first time doing this, or he's still a trainee because there's somebody watching him and telling him, you know, no, do this first, do that first. And so I finish the thing. They scan the gloves. Of course I'm fine. I put everything back in my pockets. I put my shoes on. I put my laptop back in my bag. I gather up my loose change. And then I go. But what hasn't happened is and then I go and I hang out with Amanda and I get something to eat and I see if there's any books for me to sign at the store. And then I get on the plane. And after the plane has taxied out, I realize I feel my pockets. It's one of my nervous checks. I go, do I have my phone? And then I feel my pocket. I go, do I have my pen drive? Yes, I do. It's right here, except it wasn't there. And then I'm like, what the hell? And I realize that when he ran it through the machine, he never returned it to the rest of my stuff.
Oh, no.
And so there I am on this plane. And I realize that it's not there, but I realize it's been just an hour. It's got to be at security. You know, I'm actually looking forward to getting home at 1 p.m. I've been away from my kids. And so I call Maria. And then I call you to see if you're still around, if you can swing by and grab it once they tell me, yes, we have it and it's set aside. But like my panic is extreme here because there's a few files that I will lose. Nothing essential, but some stuff. And the most important thing is that I don't know exactly what I will lose.
Right.
But worse than that is the fact that like this has book 3 on it. This has like my Bible and my Atlas. So if this gets out, like if book 3 is leaked, I mean, it will be disastrous on so many levels just because it's not a good version of book 3. This would be catastrophic for my publisher. And I mean, it would just cause so much trouble.
Right. And even if it never did cause any trouble, just the knowledge that it was sort of out there floating around in the ether would be just, I can just imagine how upsetting that would be.
And that's the big thing. And so I called and Maria was looking into it. I'm like, okay, Maria's smart. Maria can take care of this. Maria's on the job. And so I'm like, and I'm managing to kind of like, and I get snippy at you. Like we message back and forth and I'm like, I left my thing at the checkpoint. And you're like, ha 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 ha. And I'm like, it's not funny. This is the end of the fucking world. You know,
it was so perfect too. Like after that whole convention where we were both like falling apart, it was just like the perfect ending to that convention.
But then Maria says, it's not, you know, she texts me back and she says, it's not there.
Right. And we were all like on the phone, you know, with TSA telling them, no, it's there. Like it's definitely at a checkpoint A. And the guys, they were saying like, it's not there. And then we were like, well, will you go look and call us back? And like, we can't call you back, but we don't have it.
Yeah. And so,
which,
you know,
by the way, TSA, bang up job.
Man, seriously, fuck TSA.
Great job.
What I will say is I'll tell the whole story. So what I do at this point, we've actually taxied out onto the runway and we've had a message saying, sorry, the flight is delayed. You know, they're not letting us take off yet because we'll just have to, you know, because they've given us a slot or whatever they call it when they make you sit on the ground. So at this point, you know, I've got my phone out and I'm contacting you. I'm contacting, you know, the rest of my team. I'm trying to do whatever. And then I hear back, it's not there. And I'm like, the fuck it's not. I go, that means either it's sitting there waiting for somebody to just grab it. Maybe it's stuck in the bins. Maybe it's somewhere. Maybe somebody else picked it up. But I don't know. And that is just like, this is going to wreck me for a year worrying that somebody has this and they might do something with it.
Oh, what a disaster. Like, I can already imagine just like someone might try and like blackmail you or sell it to you, or like you hear horror stories about that all the time.
Or they just torrent it, you know? You know, like, you know, that's what happened to one of Stephanie Meyer's books. An early draft got out and she just abandoned the whole project. And you know, so I'm a sweaty mess. And so I make them turn the plane around.
Oh man. How did that transpire?
And here's the thing that I'm carrying. This is where I'm really carrying around a lot of guilt. Because this was, I got the text. I realized we were, you know, they weren't going to let us take off for another 15 minutes. But if I just sat there, you know, there was obviously Maria was not having no luck with the TSA and whatever else. So effectively I rang the panic button and I said,
So wait. You push the button over your head.
Yep.
The stewardess button. Someone comes over to you.
Yep.
Got man or woman?
Female stewardess.
Okay. What is she? And how does this go down?
And I say, I am freaking out. I need to get off this plane. I need to, I need to get out. I need to go back to the terminal. I need you to turn this around for me. I really need to get back out of the plane. And I don't give any reasons, but I make it clear that I am about to fall apart. And did I play it up a little bit? Yeah, I did. But the truth is, and here's the thing. I've read a lot of stories about how, like a woman gets a text from her husband who like feels awful, but she gets shut down by the stewardesses and says, no, you have to turn your phone off. And then her plane lands and she finds out that her husband has killed himself, And so as soon as I push this button, I come out of the gate full bore and I say, and I make it clear that I'm in the middle of a huge panicky freak out. Now, was I in the middle of a huge panicky freak out? Yes. Did I exaggerate it to achieve my goals? Yes, I did. And I knew how to sell it to them. And then they turned the plane around and they took me back to the terminal. The paramedic who was there, they probably assumed that I was having a panic attack.
Oh, they had a paramedic waiting for you?
Yep.
Wow.
I knew that that was.
Wait, I'm not done with my line of questioning. So they turned the plane around. She must have to go call the cockpit.
Yep.
And the other passengers, was there grumbling or were they like sympathetic?
Well, I mean, they don't know. They don't know what's going on. They know that I rang the button a bunch. And And then they come up and says, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop back at the terminal. And so, and this is effectively what I'm dealing with is the guilt of, because I've had trips and the flight gets delayed and then, and then I miss my connection. And it sucks and it wrecks my whole day. And so effectively, I know, and Amanda stayed on that flight. She said it really only led to about a 10-minute delay further than the flight was already delayed because ground control had already grounded us for half an hour beyond our takeoff. But I know that I caused people to miss their connecting flights. I know that. And that's a really hard thing for me to cop to, especially, effectively assuming the aspect of a person who is having a legitimate anxiety disorder, whereas I only have a very, very moderate anxiety disorder, which I sort of capitalized on to achieve this effect. And I honestly know that I feel bad about it and I don't know how to make it right, because I feel like I've effectively co-opted somebody else's disability, for lack of a better terms, to achieve a goal that I wanted to. And it's been riding me kind of hard for about a week. And I just have no idea, what I can do to make it good. Effectively I've taken advantage of something that perhaps wasn't mine to take advantage of and inconvenienced an entire plane load of people. All of that aside, I got back. The paramedic who was in charge was a truly impressive, kind, together person. Mm-hmm. He took care of me. He checked me out. He talked me through it, made sure that I was okay, took my vitals.
Did you tell him, I just have a hard drive at security? Or
it's exactly what I told him. I said, you know, I'm an author. You know, this I left it there. I contacted my people. They say it isn't there, but I know it needs to be there. I mean, I'm like, this is going to be a catastrophe, and it really would be. You know, I'm one of the best earners at DAW. You know, so like, if this book got out, I mean, it's going to impact like the job security of everyone at DAW. It's going to impact the job security of my entire team here. I employ. What,
and here's where the sort of like moral, like, so your sort of line of reasoning here is you're thinking about this whole plane of people and the delay that this caused them multiplied by, I mean, how big of a plane was it? Was it 4 seats across?
It was 4. Yeah.
So that's like probably 150 people.
Yep.
So, you know, you got to look at the inconvenience in their life caused a certain amount of suffering. And I can understand that moral calculus of like, this is like a butterfly effect of like, oh, it's just a small thing you did, but it multiplies out and all of those people, you know, have these issues that result in their life. But where it starts to get interesting is, let's say you didn't go back for the drive and it falls into the wrong hands, or it's, you know, it's lost. How many people does that affect? Because now it's all of your staff. It's all of your readers. It's all the people at your publisher. You know, that's a,
it's the charity ultimately, because I put a ton of the money from the books into the charity.
Right. It's the, think of all the poor families and they need a goat and they won't get a goat because your hard drive got left at security.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you not go back for it?
Well, it would have been fairly easy not to. Anyway, here's what happened. So and I have to say, I wish I knew this guy's name quite so I could thank him personally. Mm-hmm. He says, you know, I tell him what's really going on. He goes, okay. He still, you know, checks out. He's like, he's like, you've got elevated pulse. You got high blood pressure. You know.
So in other words, your fake panic attack was not so fake.
Well, there's a difference. I've known people who have had legitimate panic attacks and, you know, and it is a thing. Like, it's in the same way that like depression isn't kind of like feeling bad. Mm-hmm. You know, a panic attack is not just being really anxious. And of course there's this huge sliding scale. But so what happens is he sends security to go check with the TSA while they're kind of giving me the once over. And the security guard comes back and says, yeah, it's not there. And so I'm like, I need to go and talk to these people. I need to look into this myself. So we go, and the paramedic comes, you know? He comes and he's got his, I think like effectively his crew, because if you're gonna deal with like a really bad something going on, you want more than just a paramedic there. Mm-hmm. He comes to the, you know, right up to the thing, and I say, I say, you know, I left this here. And I spotted the guy who was talking the person through frisking me. And I said, yeah, I left something. It's a thing. And he goes, a little black thing like this big. And I feel this huge like wave of relief go over me. I go, yes, that's it. And he goes, it got turned in over there. And it's the little office, you know, the little glassed in office that kind of oversees the whole area. So we go over there, and there's a bunch of little manila envelopes from people that have left stuff there. You know, it's only 11 o'clock, and there's probably 15 of these little envelopes with names written on them or descriptions of what was in there, things that people have left behind at security. And so the paramedic goes in there, and he – and, you know, I should not maybe – you know, get on all of TSA. For all I know, this paramedic is part of TSA, right? But he goes and he's flipping through all of these envelopes and he taps them. He goes, it's thick, right? I go, yeah, it's thick. It's like bigger around than my thumb. And so he's looking. And so there's all these envelopes, but it's not in the envelopes, you know? And he's like, and he looks on the floor. He like gets down on his hands and knees and he looks on the floor. He looks behind the desk. They find it in the garbage.
What?
It's in the garbage. This guy finds it in the garbage.
God, that is insane.
And And that's kind of at the moment, I was just so happy. That meant I wouldn't have to worry about it. You know, honestly, if somebody had said, yes, we spotted it and we threw it into a fire, at least then I could have put it out of my head. But at that point, I had it back. No potential lost files. I didn't have to worry about it ending up on the internet. Everything was good. And I was just so happy. I thanked the guy like earnestly and desperately. Would have kissed him on the mouth, you know. And then, you know, and they asked me a little bit about my book. And we were all friends at that point. We'd been through a traumatic experience together. And then like this guy in a red coat came out and said, let's arrange the rest of your travel. And I'm like, and at that point, I feel like, honestly, I felt so guilty. I feel like I'd forfeited my right to take an airplane that day. And so I just rented a car and I drove the 7 hours back home. But you know, the more I think about it, I am just baffled about how it could end up in the garbage.
Someone, I tell you exactly what happened, which is someone had it and they didn't want to fill out a piece of paper saying what the date and time that they found it, and so they threw it in the garbage. And they thought, they did the math and they were like, probably no one's going to come back for this.
Well, and I suppose, I mean, if they would have known it was a computer thing, maybe they would have, but it just looked like a cylinder of black aluminum. You know, right. It said Survivor on it.
Yeah. I guarantee you someone didn't want to fill a piece of paperwork out, and so they threw it in the garbage. And I also suspect that red coat man who came out is the please don't sue the airport guy.
It's possible.
I think that's you have been materially damaged by the airline and security, and the security's, you know, TSA is not, they're not, you know, the police. Like, they're just regular people. They don't have any actual authority. So if they throw your stuff in the garbage or detain you, it's sort of, they have no real authority to do that.
Yeah. So I don't know. It had an okay outcome. Was the problem my fault to begin with? Yeah. I've been through so many airports. I'd gotten blasé about emptying my pockets in the appropriate way. I should have been a little more tuned in. I still don't know if I made the right call having them turn the plane around.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm going to carry that guilt around for a long time. But yeah, so that was the whole story. I don't know. Knowing that paramedic was probably a part of TSA and he was genuinely and earnestly concerned about my well-being above and beyond like his duty in terms of my health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was, you know, and he didn't just like kind of walk in there, feel around and go, shit, yeah, it doesn't look like it's here at all. That's a bummer. He was down on his hands and knees looking at stuff. He's the one that found it, that thought to look in the garbage and found it in the garbage. And, you know, so he's the one that, you know, that made that experience okay. Otherwise, I would have inconvenienced everyone. I would still be miserable, guilty, anxious at the loss of my files, you know, and I would have missed my flight and, but he saved my day, you know?
And now here's the other thing. I bet that you're making the plane taxi back to the gate. I bet that did not substantially delay the plane more than had it just sat on the runway waiting to take off.
It's a nice thought, but I'm betting it cost people. And I specifically asked Amanda when I got back, I go, how much time did it cost you? And she goes, it wasn't that bad. It was only 10 minutes. So
yeah, but the thing is, I'm curious, maybe someone knows how airports work, but I wonder if you forfeit, if you have to taxi back, do you forfeit your place in line? I don't know.
I'm not sure. And I know that they can make a little bit of the time up in the air. But
yeah, what is that? I go on flights all the time where something goes wrong on takeoff, you know, that we get stuck waiting on the runway, and then the guy comes on at the end and he's like, you know, we got there on time anyway because we went faster. What is that? If the plane can go faster, shouldn't that be how they go?
That's the same reason they don't always travel warp 9 in Star Trek.
It distorts the space-time continuum over a long period of time?
It's exactly the problem. Yep. They're just very forward-thinking. The EPA came down hard on them a couple years back.
I see. All right. Well, I must turn this now to a sort of information security discussion briefly. All right. I got a new the doctor has a new prescription.
Okay. Is this a cloud thing? I don't trust
you're,
the cloud.
You're going all in on the cloud, my friend. So I've already thought it through for you. All right. So here's the deal. You're going to do both. You're going to do cloud and local backups. So the first thing is all your work when you travel, it's not going to live on your drive. It's going to live on Dropbox. And you're going to set up Dropbox with a strong password. So
Dropbox is bullshit.
No, it's not bullshit. It's really good.
I hate Dropbox.
There are many alternatives. There are really good private Dropbox competitors where it's you own the drive, you own the data. Dropbox is good because it's ubiquitous. You get it on your phone, you get it everywhere. But the key with Dropbox is if you're storing you're storing your work on the book on Dropbox, the file itself should be encrypted. So in case, you know, someone gets into your Dropbox or whatever, they can't do anything with it. But B, you need to have a strong password on Dropbox, and you need to use two-factor authentication. So every time you log in, it texts your cell phone and it sends you a code so that no one who's not you can get in. That's the theory. So you also do a physical backup, right? You also have a hard drive at home in case Dropbox goes out of business tomorrow and they go away. You're still covered. But Dropbox is great because even if you're out of the country on someone else's computer, whatever the situation may be, your data is always there. So in addition to keeping your work on Dropbox and doing a local backup, I recommend a service called Backblaze. I'll put all the links to all this stuff in the show notes. But Backblaze is $5 a month, and they take, when you're asleep, they take all the stuff on your hard drive, and they back it up to their server in an encrypted file. And if anything ever goes wrong, like if you lose work or you write over something, you can go log in to Backblaze and get your file back. Or like let's say your computer gets stolen or whatever, you can pay them a small fee, and they'll actually put your files onto a hard drive and mail the hard drive to you, so you don't have to sit there downloading a huge disk image of your hard drive. But Backblaze is passive. You don't ever look at it, touch anything, do anything. It's just there. It runs in the background. $5 a month, your stuff is always backed up onto an encrypted file on their server. And you can use Backblaze to back up an external drive. Okay, next. If you're worried about data integrity on your local backup, so like what you were saying about how you had a hard drive fail, I recommend setting up a simple RAID array. So I use
that's my plan when I get a new computer.
Yeah, but don't do it in your computer. Get an external RAID array that you plug into your computer, so it always stays in one place and it's not jostling around and moving around, because otherwise your hard drives will fail. But I use a brand called Drobo, and basically I have 6 4-terabyte hard drives, and they have triple redundancy, meaning at any point, two of the drives can fail, and I take them out and I throw them in the garbage, and I pop new hard drives in, and it just copies back my data. The data is backed up multiple places on those drives.
Yeah, I still regret, because when I was getting this computer, you know, and I was going and I was getting the person to make me this computer, and I'm like, can I get like a hot swappable RAID array in this?
No, you can't. That's a bad. It's just too much for a laptop.
Well, no, a laptop.
Oh, for a desktop. Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. That more than anything will let you know like my level of comfort in computers, the fact that I resent having to use a laptop when I travel. You know, say nothing of like doing something on a phone or whatever. I just now that said, this while I sleep backup thing, I don't know if you'll be able to sell me on Dropbox, just because I've used it and it's clunky and it's ugly and it's not intuitive for me. But this thing that backs up my computer while I sleep, that I think you might have made a sale on.
I will find out. I need to do a little digging, but I'm going to find out also there's like a Dropbox competitor where it works on a drive that you own, and I'll figure that out. You may like that better. But Dropbox is just a different way of thinking about things, but it's essentially a magic folder on your computer, and anything you put in that folder gets backed up to the internet. That's all it is. It's the same as Backblaze. Backblaze just does your whole hard drive. So, okay, my final recommendations. You must I know you're going to need an external drive. That's just part of your workflow. But please, you need to invest in an encrypted drive, meaning if it gets stolen or if it gets lost, no one can do anything with it because it's, you know, it's secured with, like, you know, an MD5 hash, and they would need, like, an NSA computer to decrypt it. So I'll put a couple links in the show notes, and I'll send them to you. I like one called Iron Key. They do just encrypted external storage drives, and they can do thumb drives, like your little one, or they do big ones. I also really – I have not tried it, but there is a lot of buzz about this other vendor called Secured Drives, and they basically make a drive. It's like a little hard drive with – imagine it has, like, a screen on it and, like, a little cell phone built into it. And not only is your data encrypted, but if you ever lose the thing, you can text the drive and it will self-destruct.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I would maybe, you know, jump in there just for the fucking James Bondian nature of it. You know, and to defend myself a little bit here, I actually did look into encrypted options when I when I initiated my current backup scheme. Mm-hmm. And I looked into a lot of it. I thought, how will I encrypt it? How will I use this? You know, especially given the fact that a lot of times I work directly off my pen drive, you know? Mm-hmm. And at that point, when I set all this up, it was about 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago. I looked into the options and none of them were genuinely workable. Most of them seemed like to encrypt my drive would mostly be inviting disaster rather than securing myself.
Well, the technology's come a long way. I mean, there's always trade-offs in terms of convenience versus security and privacy. That's always a trade-off. I will say, I know this is, I'm trying to get into like a religious war here, but one of the nice things about working on a Mac, you can just turn on whole disk, you know, hardware level encryption, and you don't ever have to think about it again. So even if my, for me, even if my whole computer is stolen or, taken or whatever, A, everything is encrypted, and B, I can remote wipe it from my phone or my iPad or a friend's phone. You know, I can just go on iCloud and, wipe the whole thing.
Yeah. There, as much as I make fun of the Macs, there's a lot of the function that they provide is really marvelous, and I wish that there were analogs in the PC world. If they weren't so frickin' hipster in their form over function, they would probably have already made a sale with me. But yeah.
Boy, I'm really really exercising all of my willpower here. All right. Well, let's, speaking of, new projects that we need to start, let's, talk about what we were supposed to do last week.
Yeah.
Were you successful in handing over any work to your team of people or, Amanda, your assistant?
I have. How about you?
I did not do a great job on this. I gave Kara some small things, like she's going to help me. She's going to like set up meetings for me and then take me to the meetings because I keep missing meetings during the day.
Ah.
So that's a new one that we're working on. And I set up like an inbox and she's sort of processing my physical mail and putting stuff for me to do. Like I have a bunch of checks in my inbox I need to go sign. So it's sort of like she's sort of like consolidating things so I can do them in a more intelligent manner.
Batching, I think, is the term.
Yes, exactly.
This is a little sideways, but I still think it counts. My intention is to eventually have Amanda kind of pre-chew my email a little bit, but that is it's a project that, among other things, will require me switching from my current email to Gmail. Mm-hmm. And I've had this email account for I'm trying to count back the years, like for forever, mm-hmm. effectively, for like 13 years. Mm-hmm. So switching to a new email, like just a new thing on my computer I do email in is going to be an endeavor. But what I have started to do is I've turned over to my people orchestrating my life insurance, which I've been meaning to get for a long time, as well as my estate planning, which I am woefully behind on. It's a huge problem with authors and other creatives that they don't tend to have wills or trusts set up, and then they die, and like it's kind of a free for all as to like who owns the rights and what happens in terms of taxes and I just learned, and for any authors out there, this is a really horrible thing. I've learned that my intellectual property, it is a discrete thing which is worth money, effectively based on the royalties that it will accrue over the next eternity. When I die, and somebody inherits that intellectual property, it's valued at the amount that it will effectively produce forever. And that means, you know, if it goes over a certain amount, people are going to have to pay taxes on it. And if it goes over a lot, then they have to pay like, what's it called? The rich people.
Estate tax.
Yeah, estate tax.
Yeah, there's an exemption. You have like a 7 million. Hang on, I'm falling asleep. Between the chili dog and the tax talk.
No, no. But what this means is like, let's say you're Neil Gaiman, and I pick him because he's a huge advocate for authors attending to this while they're alive and in their right minds. Like, who is going to be your literary executor? Because there's some great books out there that nobody is sure who owns them. Or more importantly, sometimes somebody dies and they haven't made any plans, and it goes the rights to the work get into the hands of people who maybe hate the work.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can do anything about it. There's stuff in the Zelazny estate that is horribly tangled that nobody can do anything with, and it's a horrible shame. But anyway, so let's say you're Neil Gaiman and you have all this IP, and then, you know, God forbid, something happens and suddenly he has this IP that's worth $100 million. Whoever inherits that, they go, okay, you need to pay estate tax, which means half of this, you know, goes to the government. It's worth $100 million. You owe us $50 million in taxes. But the problem is that the value of that IP is going to pay out over 100 years, but they want the 50% of taxes like right then. So this is something that has just come to my attention literally this week. Anyway, I'm turning it over to my people, to help me be a grown up, help me get health insurance, help me, because I've meant to for years, but it's one of those things that I can put off. So I do put it off.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've finally been taking steps in those directions. Maria and Amanda are calling people and making sure that it happens in the right way. I've been referred to a good person who understands intellectual property law and stuff like that. And they're going to be doing the legwork on that for me. So I did manage to give away that project because it was not happening otherwise.
Yeah, this one I could have done better on, but this was a hard one. I mean, this wasn't like getting an alarm clock. This was this is like a big life change.
It is, you know, thinking of what can I get rid of and how do you orchestrate? It's a startup cost.
Oh yeah, and it's just a big like. I don't know. Like, I mean, to be honest, like, I don't do a lot of things in my life that I hate doing. Like, you know, I'm aware of the things I hate doing, or, you know, I can't tolerate doing, and I've already come up with a system to not do them. And, you know, what's left is stuff that I like doing, but I probably shouldn't be doing. Okay. So what are we going to do this week?
I don't know. Do you have any ideas? It would be sensible for us, you know, to have a week where we continue to do all the things we've agreed to,
mm-hmm.
and entrench.
Mm-hmm. So it's just the goal this week is to maintain the commitments that we've already agreed to maintain. This is what normal, you know, you realize this is what normal human beings do all the time without any special game.
Yeah, but we're idiot man babies. Okay, now hold on. I've got one. The one thing with the here's now you get to witness exactly how useless I am on a Mac.
Okay.
Because the sound is not mm-hmm. quite loud enough with the air running here.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so
you
now,
need to put on headphones. Do you have headphones?
I don't. I have them here, but I don't have them on.
Okay.
And honestly, I'm trying to remember where the hell I would even plug them into.
Okay. Tell me what. Describe what the computer looks like. Is it a laptop or is it? Is there a desktop body somewhere?
It's one of those. It's like a big landscape monitor, and everything is built into the monitor.
Okay. So your headphones are going to be on the bottom right quadrant of the back of the screen.
And bottom
there's like
right.
A little, back there's like a little sound hole back there, and you plug your headphones into the sound hole.
Okay, sound hole. You know, I understand this whole Macintosh design aesthetic, but mm-hmm. you know what computers need, Apple? They need fucking ports. It's not a secret. It's not a mystery. Gone are the days when I need to fucking crack open my hard case with a screwdriver. Now, just put a port right on the front, on the fucking front of this. Nobody is going to think less of you for that.
Oh, God. Oh.
Yeah, okay, it's there. I just forget which side my right is.
Make an L with your hand.
Both hands make L's, really.